Hi, B Culture readers. I'm Jim Tew. I'm a monthly columnist for B Culture magazine. I'm reading the article for March 2023. I've entitled it, For the Eager Honey Producer, the Classic System of Two Queen Colony Honey Production. This is an old technique for the modern mega-management beekeeper. Happily, beekeeping has kept up with many modern-day advances, but that evolving characteristic means that beekeeping today is not the same as beekeeping was many decades ago. Advances in protective equipment, improvements in honey processing equipment, introduction of new pest complexes, and large migratory operations are only a few of the myriad changes that have been occurring in our beekeeping industry. I surmise that one of the biggest changes is that modern beekeeping is now primarily known for pollination, while honey production is now the second factor for which beekeeping is known. That is exactly the opposite of what beekeeping priorities were 30 or so years ago. In the golden years of beekeeping past, honey production was the number one goal of dedicated beekeepers. Nectar flows determined the beekeeper's management schedule, and then, when possible, supplemental pollination services were sometimes provided. In many instances, neither the grower nor the beekeeper felt that it was financially feasible to use added honeybee populations. That concept has radically changed. Priorities evolved. As a young beekeeper all those years ago, I was familiar with the beekeeping priorities of the day. Yep, even then, liquid honey ruled. But even that emphasis was a change from what honey production was decades before my time. I roughly estimate that 80 to 100 years ago, comb honey was preferred to liquid honey because it could not be adulterated with sugar syrup. Comb honey was pure. Books were written about comb honey production. Talks were presented at meetings. Techniques abounded. While comb honey is still produced in newly developed plastic containers, the old tried-and-true ways of producing honey in basswood section boxes has seemingly died a long, slow death. Basswood boxes for comb honey productions are only available from a few remaining vendors, if you can find them at all. This loss is not horrendous, but it is significant. Listeners, it always bothered me that perfectly good nectar sources, basswood trees, had to be harvested to produce the unique wood that would bend into a rectangular-shaped box. But in obvious ways, moving from basswood boxes to plastic containers has only brought us different challenges. I suppose that could be a discussion for another time, but not today. My belabored point is that beekeepers once produced comb honey in basswood boxes, and now we don't. That technology is gone. That's a big change that took decades to develop. Readers, an aside, in this vein of bee things that are gone, a rarely lamented change is the move from 60-pound metal tins to common white plastic buckets. The tins could be tightly stacked on a truck, while round buckets do not stack tightly. But current plastic buckets have more comfortable handles than the small metal handles on honey tins. But you should know that the change was rapid. It seemed to me that in just 3, maybe 4 years, metal tins were dropped from catalogs to be replaced by these new plastic containers. Now I can't even find a good photo of a honey tin on the web. Things change. They always do. Back to the article. Everything I've written in this article thus far has been to get to this point. Why would I write about a dated technique that few modern beekeepers still use? Well, it was the rage then. But as with comb honey boxes and metal honey tins, things change. But if you have the energy and the interest, this is a technique you can still use in your bee operation. When I began beekeeping, one of the advanced concepts was to use two queens to build up an abnormally large population of worker bees just in time for the nectar flow. Just as the flow started, the colony that had two queens, whose brood nest was separated by a double screen or a modified inner cover, produced a double bee population. Excessive honey crops were their desired result. I need to offer a disclaimer right now. I have not tried to manage honeybees in two queen colonies in about 30, maybe 35 years. Listeners, due to the current energy and strength requirements, I doubt that I will ever try again. Never in my entire beekeeping career have I been an accomplished two-queen beekeeper, but all the advanced beekeepers of the time were giving it a try. Talks were presented at meetings. Success stories were staggering. You had to be there. At this moment, I do not know a single two-queen beekeeper, but in its day, this management scheme was widely touted. To put this article together for you, I relied heavily on the pamphlet published by C.L. Farr in August 1958, and I quote directly from his work there. Two-queen colony management represents an intensive system of honey production designed to obtain the maximum yield for each hive. During any short flow, or a flow of about 2 weeks, one large colony will produce more honey than two or more smaller colonies having the same aggregate number of bees. In single queen colonies, the production unit number of bees increases as the number in the colony increases up to the maximum, or about 60,000 bees. This efficiency relationship remains high when populations are further increased through the use of a second queen. Because small colonies increase in population with time, their production efficiency over long honey flow periods will rise. However, colonies with large populations throughout either long or short flow periods produce the greatest amount of honey because their efficiency is high over the entire honey flow period. I'm just trying to emphasize his point, listeners. A large population of bees will produce more honey than the same population housed in two or more hives. Getting an abnormally large bee population before the flow started was the reason for using a second queen. Everything about the double queen system was big. Big bee populations, big, ergo, tall colonies, big honey and pollen crops, and big management inputs were basic requirements. The results were to be big honey crops with powerful colonies passing into the following winter. A 500-pound crop, yep, 500 pounds. A 500-pound crop was not considered impossible when using this technique. A fully functional double queen colony could have the amazing population of 25 to 30 pounds of bees in it. Readers, I give a citation at this point. C.L. Farr, F-A-R-R-A-R, Two Queen Colony Management for Honey Production. His publication, AR 3348, and it's available on the web in archival form. So if you have an interest in this going beyond and more, I would certainly suggest that you read it. Back to the article. Everything about this two-queen system is in the management details. Pollen reserves are important. In 1958, our industry had not yet developed artificial pollen products. At that time, to produce large bee populations, a beekeeper would need extensive pollen sources. Obviously, your colonies can't produce brood without pollen. That same pollen reserve later became important to wintering colonies. The desire was to produce large colonies going into winter to have strong colonies for the two-queen system during the next season. Queens were also important. For this system, queens need to be purchased and be readily available. In 1958, they were, and the cost was not as great. You should be wondering if allowing part of the colony to produce its own queen was an option. And the answer is, no, not really. While it clearly could be done, valuable seasonal time would be lost while the bees were growing queens and not growing a worker bee population. It would seem to me that modern two-queen beekeepers would be confronted by queen availability during the early season of the year. I need to add that in years past, it was easier to get queens than it is now. They're more difficult to get in the spring, and they're certainly more costly, even if costs are prorated. So the queen thing is going to be a bit of a challenge. Hive equipment. Two queens with a double population naturally results in a tall colony. Due to that fact, the two-queen colony would need to sit on a firm foundation that was essentially on the ground. Hives that were seven deep boxes tall were not uncommon. So, hive stands would not be used. To forestall bees storing honey in the valuable brood nest area, honey supers were never allowed to be more than half full. As boxes were filled, they were removed and processed, and then the wet equipment was returned to the tall hive. Other than purchase cost and assembly labor, shallow equipment was not held in disfavor. The reduced weight of full supers seems to be the obvious reason. But a lesser-known reason was that some researchers felt that bees wintered better in shallow boxes. It was felt that bees wintering cluster had more interactive space to share winter food in the spaces between the boxes. In fact, Dr. Farrar wrote, and I quote, "The size and shape of the hive units have little effect on production if enough boxes are used for brood rearing, food reserves, and the storage of surplus honey." Listeners, I need to say that's an interesting observation that goes beyond this specific honey production discussion. But that can be a topic for another time. Farrar also added the comment that most efficient management was possible when all brood boxes were uniform and therefore interchangeable. The same would mostly be true for supersizes. Shallow supers were preferred to deeper supers. Apparently, bees fill and cap the shallower equipment faster than deeper equipment. Again, weight would be another prime reason for using shallow equipment. Management in this two-queen system is premier. To produce stronger colonies, you need to begin with strong colonies headed by young queens. Make everything large. Beginning 5 to 7 weeks before the flow, begin the two-queen development process. So after you've chosen the colonies and initiated the preparation, about 2 weeks later, make a strong divide from the original colony and use either a double screen or a screened inner cover to separate the split from the parent colony. In his paper, Farrar provides intricate details for the quantities of bees and brood that will need to be moved to different locations in the developing mega hive. After the new queen is installed and is producing copious amounts of brood in the split above the inner cover, usually 10 to 14 days, the screened inner cover is removed. The colonies are kept separated by queen excluders. Empty brood nest space is provided above the lowermost colony. A queen excluder is used above the bottom colony. Listeners, this is a necessity. At this point, you've got a strong queen in the lower unit with an empty box of drawn comb, which is preferable to foundation, atop the lower unit in anticipation of yet more brood production. Above the lower queen excluder is the recently introduced queen with a second brood nest with a similar configuration of brood and empty brood space. Then yet another queen excluder above the second top colony between the brood nest and the supers. The dual queen excluders confine the queens to their respective spaces and become an aid to keeping up with the two queens when the colony is opened to remove full supers and for inspection. Most of the surplus honey storage will occur above the second colony in the top of the tall colony. Again, it's important to write that the supers should be inspected and additional space added when the supers are hardly half full. Again, the intent is to discourage the bees from storing honey in either brood nest area. Swarming and supersedure were not thought to be any more relevant than swarming and supersedure in single queen colonies. If swarming was becoming an issue in a two-queen unit, the recommendation was to use the shook swarm technique to attempt to get things back into order. When I read that, listeners, I had to admit that sounds like a management headache. Not a technique for colony increase. As I started to write this piece for you, I envisioned the two-queen system having the possibility of ending the season with two colonies. While I feel that could still be accomplished, Dr. Ferrara discouraged using this two-queen system as a technique for making colony number increase. Indeed, as the season ended, he suggested just removing the excluders and allowing the bees to select the better queen. Presently, the current cost of queens would be a hindrance to that recommendation. Having a $40 queen only produced for part of a single season feels extravagant to me. However, outside the two-queen system, this general setup could still be used to assist a weaker colony to become stronger, but this is a totally different discussion. The reason for this recommendation of not using the double queen system for colony number increase was presented in his summary, included in his paper. I quote, "The larger pollen reserves accumulated after the colonies have been reduced to a single queen status make it possible to overwinter stronger colonies for the next season." Listeners, times have changed. I extensively discussed that above. Does the development of modern pollen supplements obviate some of the old two-queen system management recommendations? This whole process is not for the faint-hearted. After my experience all those years ago, and after reviewing my sources for this article, I can clearly say that this is not a management scheme for all beekeepers. Only those beekeepers with the time and the penchant for intensive colony management should take this on. The payoff is great, but so is the labor and the monetary input. Then, Jim, why would you bring this up? Like so many other things and recommendations within beekeeping, managing bees for a double queen scheme is an idea dating back to the 1930s. Does it still work? Well, it certainly worked at one time, but I can't speak specifically for the present. In the 1950s, herbicides were non-existent. Pollen and nectar sources were much more common. queens were available and were not as costly. Honey was the queen of beekeeping. But now we have ready access to pollen substitutes and other improvements. So I bring this two-queen subject up for those rarefied few of us who want to push the beekeeping envelope. That will not be me doing the pushing. If you try this technique, I'd like to know how it works out. For more information and instruction, in addition to the reference above, I refer you to the sources that I provided here. And I want to sincerely thank you for your beekeeping dedication. If you're still reading this, you're one tough beekeeper. I've not been able to do any more than introduce you to this advanced topic, but it certainly is intriguing. I know you have questions. I certainly do. Some of those sources that I cite are in The Hive and the Honeybee, page 505 through 507, and in ABC and XYZ of Beekeeping, page 679 through 680. Listeners, I appreciate you slogging through this. This is a tedious topic, but for those few of you who really want to push honey production to the maximum, this was an interesting old system that worked years ago. In some ways, it can still be made to work today if you have an interest in it. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Jim Tew, and I'll talk to you again next month. Bye-bye.